The information and opinions presented in this ARC Energy Ideas podcast are provided for informational purposes only and are subject to the disclaimer link in the show notes.
This is the ARC Energy Ideas podcast with Peter Terzakian and Jackie Forrest, exploring trends that influence the energy business.
Welcome to the ARC Energy Ideas podcast. I'm Jackie Forrest.
And I'm Peter Terzakian. Welcome. Well, September is seeming like it's coming to a close. And you know, after summer, which was a great break from all these Zoom calls, I feel like I'm right back into it. And Zooming, I don't know, like today it was like 5 hours. And it's interesting when you Zoom. I mean, there's all sorts of strange things can happen, like dogs barking and kids coming forward and so on. You know all about that, don't you?
Yeah, right. Peter's giving me a hard time because today, this may, you know, be informative for some of you out there, as I was on my Zoom call and that puppy we were talking about, you know, earlier this year is now a full-grown dog and decides to start barking very loudly and
during one of your
uncontrollably.
Presentations. Yeah.
So what do you do? It's like I'm the only one that can present this material. So do I stop, tell people to hold on while I go get the dog and throw it in the backyard? Or do you just keep talking, praying that the dog stops barking, but it doesn't stop barking? Yeah. So I think next time the plan will be, if it's important, the dog gets out of the backyard before I start.
Yeah. Or maybe have her taken for a walk. Yeah. But, you know, I think we're all pining for the good old days where we trudge to the office and we don't have these sorts of things. I'm sort of pining for the days of travel. I have to say, for the first time since January, which was the last time I got on an airplane, I sort of feel like going somewhere.
Getting itchy feet?
Yeah. I'm getting itchy feet, whether it's for business or for leisure. You know, some of the business travel that I've been on has been really intriguing. One of my favorite places has been Singapore. Well, speaking of Singapore, we've got a guest from Singapore today.
Yeah, welcome, Duncan Van Bergen, the Vice President of Nature-Based Solutions for Royal Dutch Shell.
Hi, Jackie. Hi, Peter.
Welcome.
Really wonderful to be with you guys on the show today.
So, Jackie, what are we going to talk about with Duncan?
Well, nature-based solutions. So we're going to have to learn a bit more about what that is. But Duncan, I have to tell you that I've been fascinated by this topic since really kind of the early 2019 when that Yale 360, which I wouldn't even call it a report, but it was a little blog that they wrote that said planting 1.2 trillion trees could cancel out a decade of CO2 emissions, scientists find. And ever since then, I've been just finding every article I can on this. And it is, to me, amazing that all these academics are coming out saying it has such a great impact on the climate, but yet it isn't talked about much as a solution. So that's why we're really happy to have you here, because Shell is a real leader in this area.
That's great. And I agree with you. It's something that when people get to know it, it touches not just their brain in terms of, hey, this is indeed something with quite a lot of potential, but I think it also touches a lot of people's hearts in terms of, yes, nature, I can relate to that. I think it's important. I feel it's important.
Yeah, let's get into it because, you know, when we think about mitigating carbon emissions, decarbonization, the first thing that comes to mind is swapping out our existing energy systems with renewables. The second is, okay, how do we retool our existing energy systems to bury the carbon, say, with CCS? And we don't talk that much about nature-based solutions. So it's going to be fascinating to talk with you, Duncan, about Shell's nature-based solutions. And then toward the end of the program, maybe we can switch it over to Canada and talk about the opportunities and challenges here. But maybe before we get started, tell us a little bit about yourself. How did you come in to lead Shell's global nature-based solutions business?
I've been in the energy industry for a long time, but more fundamentally than that, as you said, I live in Singapore. I've been living here for 12 years. I live here with a wonderful family. I've got a wife and three little kids. And I'm originally from the Netherlands. Professionally, I have been in the energy industry for more than 20 years, always on the business development side and running different businesses. I've been with Shell for a long time and grew up first in our downstream business and then through our growing LNG business, and ended up running Shell's business in Kazakhstan for a number of years. But then at the end of my work in Kazakhstan, more and more, I started getting extremely curious about how the world was going to make the transition to a lower carbon and ultimately a net zero carbon future. And I really wanted to have an ability to contribute to that professionally. And that's roughly around the same time, late 2017, when Shell started looking in earnest at nature-based solutions as one area of activity that could make a serious contribution in this arena. when that opportunity came up, I very immediately put my hand up and said, yes, I want to have something to do with this. And that then grew over the last 2.5 years or so into what we now call the nature-based solutions business in Shell.
And it's probably worth informing our listeners about Shell's ambitions around net zero. And I know you made an announcement fairly recently. Was it this summer? Just explain what your goal is, and that might give them some context to the part that nature-based solutions is going to play in that goal.
Yeah, you're right, Jackie. So in April of this year, so that's just to contextualize it, this is during the global pandemic and not before, Shell announced our ambition to become a net zero emissions energy business by 2050 or sooner. And we plan to do this really in three ways. First, we are aiming to be net zero on all the emissions from the manufacturer of our products by 2050 at latest. And this includes the emissions created by our operations as well as those associated with the energy we consume. The second big piece of this, because again, when you talk about climate ambitions, it's good to scratch the surface a little bit and look in detail as to how companies are proposing to make these ambitions a reality. So the second piece of what we're building is we're aiming to reduce what we're calling the net carbon footprint of the energy products we sell by 65% by 2050. And we have an interim milestone in there to reduce the net carbon footprint by about 30% by 2035. And to be clear, when we talk about the net carbon footprint ambition, that includes the emission from the use of the products we sell, the much talked about so-called scope 3 emissions. And finally, the third piece of it is we are going to be working very actively with our customers to help to work together to decarbonize, to work together towards achieving these reductions. And that means working with them to really address the emissions that happen when they consume the products.
So let's talk about those plans. I mean, so often plans in industrial corporations that emit carbon are centered around engineering, science, technology type solutions. And so nature-based solutions are, as the name implies, basically using nature as the world's engineer and using biological processes to sequester carbon. I mean, after all, trees through their leaves take in carbon dioxide and make oxygen, the lungs of the earth. And so nature-based solutions include things like planting more trees. But tell us a little bit about sort of the scope of nature-based solutions. What other types of opportunities there are for mitigating carbon through nature?
Well, you've defined it well, Peter. Nature-based solutions is all about projects, programs, interventions in natural ecosystems to allow them to do more of what they have hundreds of millions of years of experience with, which is sequestering CO2 as part of their natural life cycle. And to make it concrete for the listeners, this can be indeed about planting trees, either in degraded landscapes or landscapes that have been completely denuded of trees. But it can also be around restoring mangroves. And we recently started making a number of investments in that area. But it can also be about working with agriculture to change land management practice and agricultural practice in a way that stores more carbon in soils. And so there is a whole breadth of different methods that also includes working, for example, with the forestry industry around something that's called improved forest management, and also in different contexts, something called reduced impact logging that allows standing forests, and in some cases standing commercial forests, to increase the average carbon content there as well. What comes up in many people's minds when you talk about nature-based solutions, oh, this is about tree planting. And indeed, restoring ecosystems and planting trees is a part of it, but there's so much more.
There is so much more. And I guess in some ways a quest to get back to the way the world used to be, even in the, I would say, 14th or 15th century, where in Europe you sort of practiced things like pollarding and coppicing. You can go look all that up in Google in our audience or listeners. But, you know, these were sort of animal husbandry and the intelligent harvesting of trees and agriculture were in balance with a sustainable economy.
Yeah, although I look at two things. One thing absolutely important that I want everybody to take away is we cannot allow nature to be the forgotten solution in the context of taking action on climate change. Nature is going to be absolutely essential if we are allowed to be able to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees or less, if that's possible at all. Nature can make a real difference. As you guys yourselves mentioned, there's been study upon study over the last couple of years mentioning the potential. But just to contextualize it, there was one of those studies, 2017 one, that was published in the Journal of National Academy of Science of the United States, that suggested that up to a third of what the world needs to achieve by 2030 to be able to stay on a 1.5-degree pathway could come from nature, up to a third. So that same study, if I'm not mistaken, talks about 11.3 billion tons per year of incremental sequestration capacity in nature. So that is point number one to me, is we need to recognize that nature can play that enormous role, and it has to get out of that kind of forgotten, underestimated solution corner.
Well, and the other thing that is very compelling about it is its cost. So if we look at some of the solutions we have with industry for sequestering carbon, like through carbon capture storage, the costs per ton are very high. For example, a lot of the projects are in the range of $60 per ton, and that would be the very cheapest, and there are not very many of those, and many of them are over $100 per ton. But I read a paper, so I'd be interested in your view on it, that said that nature-based solutions were between $16 and $36 a ton to sequester carbon. So not only could it sequester a lot of carbon, it's relatively low cost.
No, I agree with that, Jackie. And I've seen a lot of the studies, and we are now an active investor in this space. And I can confirm that some of the projects we're looking at are definitely in or even below the range you just mentioned. And getting back to that paper that was lead authored by the Nature Conservancy, in their study, they said those 11.3 billion tons per year would come at a cost of less than $100 per ton, and 80% of that at less than $40 per ton. But what's important also, because you mentioned what the nature-based solutions cost versus other abatement options, for us, this is not an either-or. For us, this is an and-and. So nature-based solutions, in my mind, are not competing with other ways of abating. We're going to need all of this. I sometimes refer to this as a horse race, and I know Calgarians are very familiar with the stampede, but this is a horse race in which we as society and as corporates cannot afford to just back one horse. Yeah, we need to back all the horses, and most of them need to win if we're going to succeed with our fight against climate change. Mm-hmm. But yes, it does look competitive, and indeed, there's lots of potential.
You know, if I think back to, 10 years ago at least, there were these schemes online where, let's say, you buy an airline ticket, and then at the end, just before you checked out and got your ticket, it would say, would you like to donate money to plant trees to offset your carbon? And, you know, there's a lot of criticism of that sort of thing because the consumer really had no idea where the money went and whether it went to planting trees or not. And so what I'm getting at is, can you speak to the accounting of all of this and the quantification, the measurement, and how we can actually convince the public that, for example, Shell is offsetting a certain quantum of carbon emissions and that it's certified?
I think you're touching on two very important topics here, Peter. Number one is the customer, and number two is how do you make sure that a ton of carbon is really a ton of carbon. On that, fundamentally, I think it's absolutely essential. Integrity of these nature-based solutions needs to be impeccable. But let me start with the customer, because you mentioned airlines. Historically, these airline programs have unfortunately had a relatively low response from customers. You know, I think if you look across the global programs, historically, less than 1% of travelers actually ticked that box. And I think we spent a long time trying to understand why that was so. As a matter of fact, when we worked on the development of offers to our customers, and we are making carbon neutral offerings to customers across Europe and in a growing number of Asian countries now, we interviewed more than 4,000 customers in the lead up to that. And we consistently heard the following. Number one, there's a very large chunk of customers out there who are conscious of the emissions footprint of their activity. They're conscious that there's an emissions footprint when they drive or fly or conduct business, and they want to act. More than 60% of the respondents we spoke with said, hey, we want to take more action. But at the same time, and that's where I think you pointed to, Peter, a lot of people don't understand offsetting, not sure if they can trust it. And so we've spent a lot of time in the offers we rolled out. Some of that includes, for example, CO2 neutral driving that we've made available to retail customers in the Netherlands and the UK. And we're launching that in Germany in a couple of months. We'll be going to other markets as well. But trying to transparently communicate, how does this work? How does nature capture CO2? And how does that translate into us being able to make this offer to you? And we've had put out a whole library of YouTube videos explaining that. And so there's a lot of work that needs to be done by businesses to communicate clearly, transparently with customer how it works. But the other aspect, Peter, that you mentioned, which I think is absolutely essential, is that when we make a claim that we are selling or retiring a carbon credit, we need to make sure that that carbon credit is absolutely equal to the avoidance or removal of exactly 1 ton of carbon dioxide. And what we're doing on that front is a number of things. First of all, we only work with methodologies that are subject to third-party audits and reviews. But we've also developed a robust screening process internally to help us make sure that when we buy credits or invest in projects, that we are as certain as we can possibly be that these are real carbon sequestrations, and so that the environmental science backing that is robust. And also that as we invest in these projects, that in terms of their impact on the communities that live in and around the ecosystems that the interventions happen on, or that the impact on biodiversity is net positive. So I think absolutely crucial. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, a carbon credit is a fiat instrument based on trust, and we need to make sure that trust is earned.
Yeah, and I did a little Googling around to sort of see criticisms, and there's definitely quite a bit out there in terms of greenwashing criticism where people are saying, you know, in the past, these programs have had mixed results, and there's even been examples of fraud. And, you know, detractors are saying, you know, this is just a way for oil companies to avoid reducing their emissions by saying they're doing this, so therefore they don't have to actually directly reduce their emissions. What would be your response to that?
Well, again, it's two pieces. One is part of what Peter was asking about is how do you ensure integrity? And we spent a bit of time talking about that. But the other element, very importantly, is to address these challenges around greenwashing. And I think what's important there is in Shell, there is nobody, and I mean nobody from the top on down, who has any doubt that this will only make sense if nature-based solutions come on top of and not instead of major efforts we're undertaking to, in the first place, avoid emissions. And that includes a very large-scale investment we're doing in renewable energy, in hydrogen, in reconfiguring the power system, and also the major investments and efforts we're making to reduce investments where perhaps you can't avoid the emissions in the first place. We are absolutely clear that offsetting and investing in nature-based climate action can only be a complement to all of that, never a substitute.
Yeah, and I would say that there's more credible papers, too, that I think that have added to the credibility around this compared to even a few years ago that help people understand this is a legitimate option. I wanted to quickly ask about new technologies before we move on. There are some early stage technologies that aren't being used today. For example, reacting CO2 to form minerals such as calcite in the ocean, or growing like a whole bunch of algae and then burying it. Do you think that these solutions are going to evolve because they could even add more emissions that we could sequester potentially relatively cheaply?
You're absolutely right, Jackie. There's a lot of exciting innovation going on in this sector because it's really starting to take off. There's more and more venture capital money coming in. There's really cool technology developments that are happening in a couple of different areas. You mentioned the R&D and innovation in the area of new processes to capture carbon. There's also a lot going on in terms of how can we better monitor using satellite imagery and the like to get better ideas in terms of carbon fluxes in ecosystems, et cetera. There's also some really cool stuff happening around drone-based tree planting. So there's a lot happening. And yes, I am absolutely convinced that we will see new methods emerging and that will bring up new potential. At the same time, we need to be collectively sure that, A, these solutions work, that we can prove the environmental robustness, and that goes back to the trust, and also make sure that there are no unintended consequences, either because of the processes and the type of interventions in nature in the first place, but also to make sure there's net positive consequences for communities and for biodiversity and other environmental functions that nature fulfills.
Yeah, I guess if you grow a whole bunch of algae, you know, it may have another impact on ocean ecosystem that you had foreseen before.
Jackie, just to close off on that one, I think there are absolutely ways to do that properly to make sure that you study the impact, the full life cycle impacts, et cetera, et cetera. I am seeing enormous progress at the moment around, for example, the topic of soil carbon. People have known for years that it is possible to cultivate land in a way that stores more carbon. And what we're trying to collectively make sure now is how can we measure it in a way that it can actually robustly be turned into carbon credits.
So Duncan, one of the reasons we were excited to have you on the program because Shell is such a global leader in this area. Can you give us a sense of how much you're spending on this area? And then maybe after that, like, give us some specific projects.
We announced a short-term commitment. We would spend up to $100 million a year this year and next year in this space. And obviously, as we see projects, and if we're able to demonstrate that these are attractive investments, there's no reason why we wouldn't up that amount going forward. $200 million over 2 years may not sound like an enormous amount, but actually in the space, in nature-based solutions, that is a fairly significant commitment. I was at COP25 in December in Madrid, and I was surprised to hear Shell, together with one other company making commitments in this area, being compared to the largest state donors or investors in nature-based solutions. So a couple of examples of what we've done in the early days. One of the projects I really like, even though it's not huge, is we've invested together with the Dutch Forest Management Agency in restoring a fairly large chunk of forest that was lost due to ash dieback in the Netherlands over the past couple of years. And I think we're in a program that will plant more than 15 million trees. And remember, the Netherlands is a lot smaller than Canada, so it actually does make a difference. And these areas that we're helping restore are really crucial for recreation and for biodiversity. And Shell will, as a result of that investment, get the carbon credits that are going to come out of this. And we've done similar investments in other areas in Europe and also in other parts of the world. And recently, another example is we agreed to acquire a company in Australia called Select Carbon, who are really one of the leaders in Australia around what's called carbon farming over there, which is about working with landowners to implement projects that increase the carbon content on their land and turn that into ACCUs, which is the Australian version of a carbon credit. And we're really excited about that. Select Carbon has the science, the team to really make a difference in Australia. And it'd be interesting to see how some of those methods can be applied in other countries, including in Canada.
Do you have anything going in Canada?
We're really excited about the opportunities in Canada. We've been talking and looking at what would be good projects for us to invest in. I've got nothing that I can announce right now on the show, but I'm really excited about the potential in Canada.
Well, let's come back to more details on Canada and some of the opportunities and challenges we have. But I wanted to dig more into the example you talked about briefly before around Shell asking the buyers of their fuel to voluntarily offset their emissions with nature. So in some regions, and you can tell us which ones, because it sounds like it's a little bit bigger than I expected, you're adding a penny a liter to the bill, and this would offset some of the emissions associated with the burning the fuel in their tank. So my first question is, does that penny per liter actually offset all the emissions, or is it just a portion? And then which markets are you doing that, and how many people are choosing to pay that extra amount?
Great question, Jackie. And indeed, we've launched CO2 neutral driving for our retail customers. So that's people who come to Shell service stations. We started with it in the Netherlands in early 2019 and then moved it to the UK. We've got plans to launch it in Germany, Austria, Switzerland later this year. And we have more markets on the agenda. To answer your question on customer response, the customer response has totally exceeded our expectations. At some stage, and it obviously follows cycles as we communicate more on it, but at some stage, more than 1 in 5 of our customers in the Netherlands was choosing to opt into this program. So that's really exciting. And yes, to answer your question, we are covering the entirety of the emissions associated with the fuel they buy from us. But there is clearly a response. Now, on top of what we're doing in the retail, so in the service stations area, we've also launched offers for our fleet customers. So these are customers who have either large fleets of passenger vehicles or trucks, commercial road transport customers. And that offer is live, if I'm not mistaken, in more than 10 countries in Europe, and is now also live in at least 3 geographies across Asia. Just quickly rounding up, we are also having really strong customer response in our LNG business, where we've been selling CO2 neutral LNG cargoes to customers in Japan, Korea, Taiwan, China over the last month. And again, there's a lot of excitement there. But what's important is when we speak with our customers, we don't say that this is the solution. Yeah, we want to make options available to our customers. And so if you're a service station customer of ours, we really also want to increasingly make electric vehicle recharging options available to you.
Well, and I think it's so innovative. You know, you may not be able to afford a Tesla today, or you don't have the hydrogen car yet or infrastructure, but for a cent a liter, you can offset your emissions. And just for context, you know, Canada's carbon tax right now is $30 a ton, which equates to 7 cents per liter. I don't think that does anything to stop people from driving more, no. You know, 7 cents a liter. But if we put a penny of that towards nature-based solutions, it actually would offset their emissions. And it would, I know we're not doing that with the money today, but I think that would be a great idea.
Yeah, I think it speaks to sort of, the lower cost of mitigating emissions through nature-based solutions. And maybe, Duncan, can you speak, though, that there is a wide differential? Like, I mean, you've spoken about the Netherlands and the work that you're doing there. Some potential excitement in what you're going to do here in Canada. But isn't the reality that nature-based solutions like the plant absorption and plant growth characteristics of equatorial countries is far better than northern latitudes?
I think the opportunity across the world is pretty big. Now, you mentioned equatorial countries. Yes, forests tend to grow faster. There's also a lot of carbon sequestered in standing forests in those areas, and it's important that we do everything we can to preserve and to slow down the rate of deforestation there. But bringing it to Canada, if you ask me, well, what's the potential here? I would quantify it very scientifically as somewhere between big and huge. There have been a number of studies, including one, I think, by the Nature Conservancy, but we've also done work with a couple of specialists, studies that suggest that there is at least 50 million tons a year of potential, and other studies that suggest it's 10 times or more of that. So yes, trees grow faster in the equatorial region generally, but it doesn't mean that there isn't vast potential in other parts of the world.
Can you quantify it in terms of dollars per ton for mitigating carbon, say, for a nature-based solution in Canada?
Well, Peter, first, I think it's important to recognize that nature-based solutions covers a whole range of methodologies. And let's make it Canada specific. In Canada, I think you could do indeed reforestation, but you can also do improved forest management. Yeah, working with landowners and foresters to change the patterns of how you grow and harvest trees. You could imagine working in the farming sector with rangers in terms of how you run cattle on farms, but also how you grow crops, how you integrate trees in that context. So it's a broad field. But I think the numbers that Jackie mentioned earlier, and I think, Jackie, if I'm not wrong, you spoke about $15 to $30 a ton. I think many of the opportunities in Canada will find themselves in that range. I think there'll be some others where you say, hey, look, to do this properly, it's going to cost a bit more than that. think that's also possible. But do I think a large portion of that big to huge potential will find itself in the $15 to $30 a ton range? I think that's correct.
One more question about Canada. You know, I believe in Canada, one of the barriers we have for nature-based solutions is that we have a bunch of provinces, each with their own system for carbon, their own offset programs. You know, it may be that the cheapest thing to do in Canada would be to plant trees on our West Coast, BC, our most mild temperatures. But if you do that in BC, you can't necessarily get a carbon credit in Alberta or a different part of the country. Do you see that this is a barrier? Like, I noticed you made that acquisition in Australia. Is it better there? Does it make it more interesting for investing in these types of solutions in countries that are more coordinated across the entire country?
Well, Jackie, let's start with the positive, which is Canada is recognizing this potential increasingly and wants to see the nature-based solution sector happen. So I think that's a positive. And indeed, you've got a couple of systems that are starting to emerge. Obviously, Alberta has been in this space for quite a while, British Columbia. But you are right. It would be great if these systems were to start harmonizing more and more. And you draw the comparison with Australia. Australia has one system that manages the different protocols or methodologies for how you can claim carbon credits across Australia. And yes, that would help. It would help tremendously. So I'd be a big fan of that.
Yeah, and I think that for offsets generally in the country, it would be a big help, but especially for nature-based solutions, because I imagine there are some local, you talked about these low-cost opportunities, but they're not necessarily available in every province of the country.
Well, it's been a fascinating conversation, Duncan, on a subject that I think we're going to be hearing a lot more about because of its tremendous potential in a very complicated portfolio of solutions that we need to offset the effects of climate change. So thank you very much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you both very much. I think it's an exciting topic at an exciting time. I think Canada, with its potential, ought to play a world-leading role in this space. When I was in Canada last, I spoke with a number of people about what I call the Canada paradox. And the Canada paradox to me is that Canada is at times being talked about as an importer of carbon credits under the Article 6 of the Paris Agreement. I think Canada, with its enormous nature potential, ought to have as an aspiration to say, look, not only are we going to be able to make nature play a big role in how Canada transitions to a net zero future, but perhaps even as an exporter of mitigation outcomes. So let's try to turn that one around.
Well, thank you for the vote of confidence, and thank you for being on the show.
Yeah, thanks for the inspiration. All right, if you enjoyed our podcast, please tell someone else about us and rate us on the app that you listen to.
For more ideas and insights, visit arcenergyinstitute.com.